This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, Canada.
Mother Earth is under the weather right now. Mother Earth is under the weather right now.
The UN says Earth is losing 3 species a day in the largest mass extinction event since the end of the dinosaurs. But don't worry, as we'll hear from our guest today, we're adding 1 million new humans a week. So much news, so little planet. This is Alex Smith, your host for Radio EcoShock. Today we'll hear from Dr. John Guillebeau in London about how we need population control if we ever hope to control climate change. Catherine Stewart of Living Oceans also joins us to talk about the new government report calling for closed containment for fish farms. And we'll premiere a new song by Madonna, part of the launch of the Live Earth Concerts for a Climate in Crisis. But first, let's get a quick roundup of the news from nature.
We are the caretakers, guardians of the earth, caretakers. Time to do a little more caring and a little less dick.
We'll start with a crisis that could grind down civilization as we know it, climate change. Global energy use is predicted to skyrocket, and greenhouse gases will go up exponentially. According to a news report from AFP, the French wire service, world energy consumption is expected to climb 57% by 2030. The Energy Information Administration of the U.S. government predicts the developing world will plug in and drive all over Africa and especially Asia, which may surpass even the United States within 2 decades. Their energy use will increase by 57% in that period. The American government sees the world using 118 million barrels a day of oil and gas by 2030, instead of the 83 million barrels a day in 2004. They think the OPEC countries will increase production by 21 million barrels a day to meet that demand. Will it happen? Not if you believe the peak oil experts like Matt Savinar, who say the Middle East reserves have been grossly exaggerated to get a bigger OPEC quota. For the sake of the climate, we better hope he's right. The atmosphere can't take more decades of oil burning. If oil does get scarce, the result could be worse. The Americans predict world coal use will climb by 2.2% a year, a deadly development for us all. In all, the Energy Administration sees the energy-related carbon dioxide emissions rising from 27 billion tons in 2004 to 34 billion metric tons by 2015 and 43 billion metric tons in 2030. Up, up, and away for greenhouse gases. The Associated Press tells us that crops and wild plants are already suffering from climate change. The original versions of food plants, like the wild potato and the peanut, may go extinct, impoverishing our gene pool. The Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research says that more than half these wild food species could go extinct within the next 50 years. Meanwhile, the rump government of George Bush, those that have survived the latest investigations and scandals, continue to fight off efforts to save the climate. The state of California has warned it may have to sue the federal government just to get greener car legislation enforced. In 2002, California passed legislation requiring automakers to reduce vehicle emissions by 30% by 2016. Seems like a fairly tame goal, but the Bush-dominated EPA has stalled the state for a year and a half so far. California Attorney General Jerry Brown said, quote, "Our patience is wearing thin. We watch the president and his EPA acting in collusion with the auto and oil industries while we want to take reasonable, constructive steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions," end quote. Cleaner cars are part of California Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's plan to reduce the state's carbon dioxide emissions by 25% by 2020. Americans themselves aren't helping. Despite record-high gas prices, they continue to burn 385 million gallons a day, paying out over $1 billion daily, mostly to foreign producers. Unbelievably, a whole lot of Americans continue to buy gas-guzzling SUVs. Michael Taylor of the San Francisco Chronicle found that after a 2-year slump, sales of SUVs are higher than in 2006, much higher. Large SUV sales rose 6% in the first quarter of 2007. April sales of gas hogs were 25% higher than in April of 2006. As Taylor writes, quote, "The bigger the guzzler, the better the numbers. Sales of GMC's Yukon XL were up a whopping 72% last month, and the totals for its Chevrolet sister, the Suburban, rose 38%. Topping off the tank on either one can cost as much as $120. End quote. Part of the reason? The American automakers are phasing out production of the family minivan and replacing it with larger so-called crossover vehicles. Another big factor, obese Americans, often weighing over 250 pounds, need the room and suspension of a pickup truck just to carry them around. Dan McKenzie at the Union of Concerned Scientists say, we already have the technology to increase average fuel economy by 60%, going from under 25 miles per gallon to 40, without sacrificing the size of the vehicle. Manufacturers just aren't using the tech. Many Americans seem to be saying, to hell with the climate, go big, and go dead. In the face of such stolid resistance to change, Greenpeace is just one environmental organization starting to panic. The organization set up a fake Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat last week. In Turkey, Greenpeace campaigner Hilal Atiki said, climate change is real. It's happening now, and unless world leaders take urgent, decisive, and far-reaching action, the next decades will see human misery on a scale not experienced in modern times. Meanwhile, scientists are struggling to understand how Earth copes with masses of new carbon dioxide. We know that a huge portion of our emissions has been stored in the ocean. Now, research from the Southern Ocean below Australia shows this protective carbon sink is filling up. It can't absorb all the new emissions predicted for the next 25 years. Let's listen to a report from ABC National in Australia.
In their latest findings published in the journal Science, researchers say the planet may be warming up at a greater speed than current modelling suggests, and they say the Southern Ocean around Antarctica is one of the world's largest carbon sinks, but they say it doesn't appear to be able to absorb as much greenhouse gas as it has in the past. Barbara Miller reports.
The Southern Ocean absorbs about 15% of the world's emissions of carbon dioxide, making it extremely important in regulating global temperatures. But British-based researchers say increased winds caused by greenhouse gases and ozone depletion is churning up the carbon in the ocean and bringing it to the surface. This leads to a release of some CO2 into the atmosphere and greatly reduces the further absorption of greenhouse gases. Dr. Corinne Le Kerry from the University of East Anglia in England is the lead author of the report. She says it's not clear what impact the increased carbon in the atmosphere will have on temperatures.
We know from observations in the distance past, so 10,000 years and so on, that every time the Earth has been warmer, CO2 in the atmosphere has been higher. So we know that the sinks respond to a warmer planet by outgassing CO2 in the atmosphere. We just don't really know how fast this happened and how big the effect is going to be.
But the researchers are describing their findings as alarming. That's a point Tom Troll, Associate Professor at the Institute of Antarctic and Southern Ocean Studies at the University of Tasmania, agrees with.
The key finding is that the rate of ocean uptake of atmospheric CO2 that we have observed over the past 50 years will not continue into the future. That rate will decrease. Because of that, our need to reduce emissions to keep atmospheric CO2 levels below dangerous levels, that is, levels that could induce dangerous climate change, will become even more difficult. We'll have to reduce emissions more to keep atmospheric CO2 low because the ocean will not be taking up as much as we had hoped.
So this is a real warning to anyone involved in planning, making plans to combat and adapt to climate change.
It is definitely a wake-up call that the problem will be difficult and perhaps more difficult than we'd hoped. And the differences are large, as shown in this paper and in other recent work, in that we might have a difference by that decreasing ocean uptake, where we could only emit, let's say, 200 gigatons less in the next century than we could if the ocean were continuing to take up the CO2. And to put that in context, you know, a couple hundred gigatons, or let's say, even, suppose it's only 100 gigatons less that the ocean takes up because of the changes in the winds and the ocean circulation, that's equivalent to what we emit now in about 15 years of our total emissions. So these changes in the ocean uptake, but also the land uptake into the future, may mean that we have to be even more stringent in moving to reduce CO2 emissions. And I think that is the alarming aspect.
Dr. Tom Trowell from the University of Tasmania. That report by Barbara Miller.
Staying with Australia for a moment, the leader of the opposition, Kevin Rudd, has called on the Australian Navy to protect whales in the Southern Whale Sanctuary from the annual Japanese whaling expeditions. You may remember last winter, Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society fought a running battle with these so-called scientific whalers as they dragged out hundreds of whales from the sanctuary. Greenpeace showed up as the whaling mothership was stranded and drifting after a serious onboard fire. Kevin Rudd may well move from the opposition to being Prime Minister in the upcoming Australian elections. The public there is angry about Australia's involvement in the Iraq War and about Prime Minister John Howard's utter failure to address climate change. Farmers are being wiped out and whole parts of the country are burning due to a 10-year drought thought to be caused by a shift of winds brought on by a shift in climate. Mr. Rudd, a conservative, has been very strong in his calls for action on climate change. Prime Minister Howard, backing the country's giant coal industry, has taken the George Bush approach to climate change. Deny, fudge figures, and fight off change. He's not likely to last long. It would be a real relief to see action down under on the climate and genuine protection for the whales by the Australian Navy instead of a few environmentalists in unarmed boats. You may be relieved to hear that a recent survey of members of the International Whaling Commission shows that despite Japanese bribes and finagling, there are not enough votes to lift the international ban on killing whales. Juichi Sato, oceans campaigner for Greenpeace Japan, says it's 100% sure the moratorium is safe. Good news for our friends, the whales in the oceans. Back in Canada, a prominent environmentalist and green donor has been shot dead in the parking lot of the World Wildlife Fund. Glenn Davis, 66, was a multi-million dollar supporter of wildlife and conservation causes in Canada. Davis inherited his fortune, estimated at over $100 million, from his father, who was active with Conrad Black back in the days of the Argus Corporation, an industrial empire. He lived quietly and plainly and escaped death in the 1983 airplane crash of an Air Canada jet in Cincinnati. Davis was just one of 18 survivors. In 2005, someone beat Glenn Davis severely, a case that was never solved, and it may be linked to a shooting on May 21st in Toronto. The Toronto Star carries this estimation of Davis from a leading Green, quote, Elizabeth May, a friend of Davis and leader of the Green Party of Canada, said yesterday that about a third of his time he spent in the wilderness trekking in remote locations, and about a third of his time was devoted to what business dealings he had that remained, and the last third of his time was dedicated to philanthropy to a number of causes, primarily environmental causes, but also the Canadian Women Olympic rowers, end quote. Glenn Davis donated millions of dollars a year to conservation causes, primarily through his favorite charity, the World Wildlife Fund of Canada. Some species and essential wildlife habitat may have been saved by this one man alone and his generosity. The story is developing as to who killed him and whether his fortune will continue to benefit the environment. Also in Canada, Jonathan Porritt, the UK sustainable development guru, featured 2 weeks ago on Radio EcoShock, has a strong message for Canadians. Here's a clip from a show called The Current on the Canadian Broadcasting Network.
In our last half hour, we brought you the story of Ashton Hayes, the first village in Britain that's trying to go carbon neutral. Dozens of other villages plan to follow this strategy, but is going green from the ground up the best way to go? Our next guest has some ideas. Jonathan Porritt has been a British environmental leader for more than 30 years. He led the Green Party here in the 1970s and 80s. Today, he's the founding director of Forum for the Future, an environmental charity, and he was appointed by Tony Blair to head Britain's Commission on Sustainable Development. He joins me now. Good morning.
Morning, or afternoon, whenever it is.
What do you think of this local approach that they're doing in Ashton Hayes, where it's coming from the ground up and it's run by volunteers?
These initiatives are enormously important. They're actually very inspiring. They really do get people turned on. You can see how individual action scaled up to village or community level provides a sense of momentum which would otherwise be lacking. And I've visited Whistler, for instance, in British Columbia, which is a sort of similar community-driven initiative of this kind. But the real question is just how much change are they really making? If you look at the bigger picture side of it, could we, for instance, rely on thousands, hundreds of thousands of community-based campaigns of this kind in order to bring about the nature, the transformation that's really required? And the answer to that question is no, it's not enough. It's hugely important, but it just isn't going to do it for us.
Why isn't it going to do it?
The scale just isn't right, and the individual citizen on his or her own just can't make the changes that are now required. We really do depend on governments, we depend on large businesses to help drive down those negative impacts, environmental and social impacts.
Well, aren't we at that stage now? Isn't it time for government to start thinking big? And if it is time, you know what thinking big means. What are the really radical changes that government should be primed and ready and brave enough to take?
It's difficult to know what else governments need to get them really moving on this. The harder stuff undoubtedly entails paying more for the use of our fossil fuels. The reason why we've got such a problem with climate change is that we haven't paid anything for our use of the natural world, for our use of the environment. So, to use economist jargon here, we haven't included the cost of carbon in all of our dramatic improvements in lifestyle. And eventually that does mean we're going to pay more for our petrol and diesel in our cars, we're going to pay more for the privilege of flying, we're going to pay more for the use of energy throughout the economy. And that means we'll get a lot more efficient, a lot smarter at using energy.
Well, let's pull it back a little bit more. We started in a village, now we're on the national stage. What about internationally? People look to Britain and they do see it as a leader in terms of matters environmental. And in London, for example, the congestion charge, the city has led the world in that. Other cities are starting to emulate that. What can this government do here to lead the rest of the world through the next stages?
We need to take the example of London, which you mentioned, which is very inspirational. London now has got the most ambitious climate change action plan of any big city in the world. 60% reduction in CO2 emissions, 60% by 2025. It's an extraordinary initiative. And if the UK could get smarter about sharing some of that knowledge, about working with other countries, particularly countries like China and India, then I think we'd see the UK leadership taken on to a new level.
As you mentioned, you were just in Canada on the West Coast. What lessons can Canada learn from the United Kingdom?
As a nation, Canada has always been held to punch above its weight, as one puts it, on big international issues. And the really serious failure of Canada to get going on climate change over the last 5 years has been a big hit on that international agenda. People have been very concerned about that failure. And watching the machine now cranking up at both the provincial level and the federal level, at the national level, it's very interesting to see people are beginning to accept that there's such a chronic level of wastage across the Canadian economy. Unbelievable levels of wastage in terms of just the way cities work in Canada, the way transport policy works, the way industrial policy works. You could squeeze out 20-30% of total energy consumption in Canada, and not a single Canadian citizen would feel the ill effects of that because you're such a wasteful economy. So I can see why this is difficult at one level, but then you think resource efficiency, increased productivity, good for the economy, good for the individual citizen, good for the environment. So what's the problem? And the problem is a failure of political will. That's the truth of it.
Well, what can they learn from the UK about that? I mean, there's going to be some listeners who are hearing you and getting, quite frankly, probably a little upset that you're lecturing them about how they should be living their lives in Canada. And you've already said that the UK probably isn't one to boast about its record.
No, indeed, and I put all these things in context. I hope they're not getting too upset, because if your individual listeners are getting upset about it, let me just remind them that if every single person on the planet today lived the lifestyle of the average Canadian citizen, we would need 5.5 planet Earths to maintain that style of living. 5.5. That's your total planetary footprint. In the UK, it's 3, okay? So you guys are almost twice as impactful as we are here in the UK. So I'm not letting anybody off the hook here, and I'm entitled to make comments, I hope, around the world, because I'm trying to do this as objectively and dispassionately as I can. What anybody can learn from the UK is that actually people are keener for this to happen than their politicians think they are. Show the right kind of leadership, provide the right kind of incentives for the business community, drive efficiency improvements through the economy, and the return from citizens is enthusiasm, is support.
All right, Jonathan Porritt, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks.
Jonathan Porritt headed Britain's Green Party in the 1970s and 80s and currently chairs the UK Commission on Sustainable Development.
That was Jonathan Porritt on the CBC program The Current. I am saddened to report that the only daily environmental program in the United States called EcoTalk has gone off the Air America network. Due to lack of sponsors, their last show was on Friday, the 18th of May. EcoTalk had the best guests in the world to talk about the environment. Top scientists, governors, senators, and Greens had a platform to reach millions of Americans through the Air America network. Due to its own financial problems, Air America was unable to pay host Betsy Rosenberg and her small staff, and I happen to know she put about $100,000 of her own money into it just to get the green message out there. She was a really dedicated radio host, and I know she's going to come back. They were left to raise their own sponsors while producing an intensive show every day. Apparently, in the billions spent on advertising crap in the USA, there weren't enough dollars to report on the demise of Mother Earth. We'll miss Betsy and the EcoTalk gang, and I hope they find some new sponsors to get back on the air. How pathetic that the most vicious talk show thugs make millions raking up stupid scandals, while the fate of the earth ain't worth supporting or reporting. Betsy went out with a new song by Madonna, written and released for Al Gore's series of concerts to save the planet called Live Earth. In a departure from the usual controlling record industry, this song called Hey You was and is available for free MP3 download. You can see if it's still available at liveearth.msn.com. Here it is, dedicated to Betsy Rosenberg and EcoTalk, Madonna, with Hey You.
Hey you, don't you give up. It's not so bad. There's still a chance for us. Hey you, just be yourself. Don't be so shy. There's reasons why it's hard. Keep it together, you'll make it alright. Our celebration is going on tonight. Poets and prophets, what envy what we do. This could be good. Hey you. Sense. Hey you, first love yourself. you can't try to love someone else. Keep it together, we'll make it alright. Our celebration is going on tonight. Poets and prophets will envy what we do. This could be
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on the People's Radio, Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. That was Madonna's new song for the Live Earth Concerts, popping up around the world on July 7th, 2007. That's 7707 for Worldwide Concerts to Save the Planet, featuring artists like Madonna, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, The Police, The Dave Matthews Band, Smashing Pumpkins, John Mayer, and The Beastie Boys, to name just a few. The web address for more info, videos, and music is liveearth.msn.com. Incidentally, this is the first sign that the Bill Gates Microsoft empire is wising up to climate change. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been doing commendable work, providing medical care to Africa's poorest. But so far, they haven't publicly recognized that Africa is being wrecked by greenhouse gases from the developed countries. Africa's Lake Chad was once the world's fifth largest body of fresh water. No more. Following years of drought, the lake has almost disappeared, leaving a former fishing fleet grounded in the sand. The whole of North Africa is being desertified, not by careless tribespeople there, but by a shift of winds in the Indian and Atlantic Oceans that divert seasonal rains. As author Tim Flannery points out, we did it with our fossil fuel emissions. Hopefully the Gates and now the Buffett charitable billions will recognize climate change as an issue that needs heavy funding now, especially since government is failing us. That's it for World Eco News from me, Alex Smith. Download our weekly program from our website at www.ecoshock.org, plus tons of other great green audio, all free, no commercials, nothing to sell, everything to save, at www.ecoshock.org.
Focus on a different kind of campaign to persuade people in this country and around the world that we have to respond to the climate crisis. It's by far the most dangerous crisis our civilization has ever faced.
It isn't just reducing the size of the footprint, it's also the number of feet.
When it comes to climate change, the elephant in the room is the huge growth of the human population on the planet. This is true not only in absolute numbers, we are 6.5 billion now and expected to hit 9 billion or more, but also the growth of Western-style supercarbon consumers. To discuss this, we have Dr. John Guillebeau on the line. He's the Emeritus Professor of Family Planning and Reproductive Health for UCL, University College London. Dr. Guillebeau, how are you, and can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Alex. Yes, it's great to talk to you. I was born in a little country called Burundi, and brought up in Rwanda, Uganda, and Kenya. And as a medical student at St. John's College, Cambridge, I attended a lecture which absolutely changed my life. We're talking now 40 years ago plus. And the lecturer was a biologist. And he said to me, said to us in a small group in the St. John's College Medical Society, do you know we already have 3,000 million people in this world? Well, by the end of the century, we're going to have 6,000 million and rising. And as a biologist, I know that is a very dangerous thing, because if any animal, any species, breeds too well, it will outgrow its resources, and you get a population crash eventually. So that's where I came into the business of being an environmentalist, because I said to myself, I'm a doctor. At the time, I wasn't sure what branch of medicine to go into, whether I was going to do cancer research or something like that. But I said to myself, the most important branch of medicine is obviously family planning. And so I geared my whole career to be a specialist in family planning. And I can say without fear of contradiction, I'm probably the only gynecologist in the world who chose his specialty of gynecology and surgery, because I do vasectomies on men as well, on environmental grounds. In fact, my slogan is, the pill and the IUD are as much icons of the environment as is my collapsible bicycle that I use when I carry when I travel by train.
And yet we don't hear the large green groups talking about that. It seems to be a pretty hot issue. Your team...
It's taboo now. In the 60s and 70s, people were talking about it, and then suddenly it became a completely taboo subject.
Is it the impact of the far right or the evangelical churches, do you think, or even the Catholic
in
churches?
In your country and in the States, yes, it definitely is. But they spin off into the rest of the world. I mean, clearly the Catholics as well have a strong influence in this regard. And then the rest of the people who are not religious are afraid to hurt their feelings, and they feel that sort of political correctness stops them talking about it.
And now your team has suggested the real way to fight climate change is to limit our population growth. Have you had a big reaction to that?
We have had a big reaction, but in a sense, it's not rocket science. I mean, it's simple as this. Everybody talks about reducing one's carbon footprint, that is essential, especially for us in the rich countries of the world, to do that. And I'd correct your question by saying we don't think it is the way, but we think it is an important and neglected way, because what we say is it isn't just reducing the size of the footprint, it's also the number of feet. And it's not rocket science. You know, it's quite straightforward. If you have people who are exceeding the carrying capacity of their bit of land, as in our case, for example, in Britain, we are living on three times our land area by importing resources. We've got to reduce our per-person imprint on the planet, but it would help to have fewer persons as well, reduce the number of feet.
So what is the relationship between population and climate change?
We've worked it out, and we say that if somebody decides to have one child less than they otherwise would, we think that two is a simple, sensible guideline, because if you have two children, you're replacing the couple who have the children. And so you are eventually going to have a stable population. But some people can have three, because a lot of people choose to only have one or two anyway in the rich countries. So you are allowed to be a bit variable around the two as a guideline. But if you have one child less than you were planning, say three instead of four or one instead of two, do you know, Alex, that means that it's the same thing as 620 return flights across the Atlantic in terms of carbon footprint. That non-existent person will therefore not be doing that much of CO2 production. Or an even more convincing statistic is that if you have one less person in a developed country arriving, then it's the equivalent to 3 million miles being driven in a Toyota Prius, which, as you know, is the most economical car around, the hybrid. 3 million miles, or have another baby.
Well, it seems like there are really two types of population growth. I mean, there's a big difference between one more child in rural India and a new resident in London. Can you explain that?
True. I mean, my view has always been holistic and a world view, and that's probably partly because I was brought up in Africa, and I've always had a huge desire to help the poor of the world. At the moment, half the world is rich and half the world is poor, in rough terms, something like 3,000 million are the haves, and about the same again are the have-nots of the world. And the have-nots are mostly in Africa, India, and China, and the Middle East. And if you have one less child in Africa, say, and I find in Rwanda, for example, when I went back there last October, the country I was brought up in, there is an unmet need for family planning. The women, if you talk to men, they want huge families, but the women want less. So if we help them in those countries also to have one less child at least, that one less child will cost less for us in the West to help them to get out of poverty. Because wouldn't we like to wave a magic wand, Alex, and really have everybody in the world living a decent life? And the only way out of poverty is to use energy. And using energy at the moment means burning fossil fuel and creating greenhouse gases. So I've done that calculation and said to myself that if we could help people in Africa to have each family to have one less child, that saves 1 million miles. Not 3 million, but 1 million miles of fossil fuel burning in a car, to get them out of poverty to live at a decent lifestyle, which you could do with one-third fossil fuel production of what we use in Britain, and probably about one-fifth of what you use in Canada. Are you with me? The argument applies, actually, in both rich and poor countries. In the rich countries, we have one less child in order to save that huge amount of greenhouse gas reduction. In the poor countries, we help them to have fewer, which then means that it's less of an endeavor for us to find the energy for them to get up to a reasonable standard of living, as I say, the equivalent of 1 million miles.
So economic justice also has its carbon cost.
Absolutely right. And this is what's forgotten so often. People just sort of say, well, you know, we've got to reduce our per-person consumption, and they completely forget that the number of persons is increasing enormously all the time, all over the world. And it's actually of environmental relevance, as well as a matter of just straight justice, economic justice, to help the people in the developing world who don't want children not to have them. You see, this is the myth. You know, you've heard about this probably, that people say in a country like mine in Rwanda, or the place I went to school in Uganda, they say they want large families in order to look after them in their old age, and because a lot of children are dying. And there is some truth in that. But they don't want the biological maximum. The biological maximum of children that a woman can have is 10. And they probably only want 4 or 5. And the silly thing is they're forced to have 7 or 8 because we do not provide the resource in family planning terms to enable them to have the choice of contraceptives that the women in the West, take as a matter of for granted.
Right, and as the birth rate in Europe and North America stabilize, the biggest growth of carbon consumers is now immigration from the developing countries. But if we discuss this, well, the racist label comes out pretty quickly. How do you suggest Absolutely. We handle that?
Well, I think the answer is to say, let's look at the whole world and say that if in fact somebody moves from a rich country to a poor country, they are going to have the same impact on the planet, if at any given standard of living, as they would have, wherever they are from. And if we believe that the right thing to happen is for the whole world to live a decent life, all those 3,000 million people to be got out of poverty, it really then doesn't matter whether they do their burning of fossil fuel in the country they came from or by moving to a new one. It's the same impact on the planet. But the ones they move to are usually already highly densely populated, certainly as far as Europe is concerned. It is not logical for the numbers to come to Britain to be the sort of numbers that would deal with the whole problem of 3,000 million people who are poor in the world. And therefore, we are the third most densely populated patch of land in the world, for a start. And if you went to Canada, although you look as if it got an awful lot of land, an awful lot of it is tundra and ice, isn't it, at the moment at least, and not very usable. So most countries actually are getting close to overpopulated now, and the answer to deal with world poverty is not to have people moving from rich to poor countries. It's to do the just thing, which is to make the poor countries rich. I mean, do proper development, which helps the people not to have to feel they've got to leave to come across the borders in the first place. That's what should be happening.
Certainly that's one answer for Mexico and Latin America, where a lot of the population immigration is coming from here, and for Africa, where it's coming your way.
That's right. I mean, we must be human about it, humane about it. I mean, certainly in the UK, we believe you should welcome all true asylum seekers, all true refugees, just absolutely without question. There's no debate about welcoming them. But when it comes to economic migrants, we feel that a country like England, that is the third most densely populated country on the planet, should only accept newcomers at the rate that they emigrate. So the numbers who leave Britain, which is about 300,000 a year, we can also welcome with open arms up to that number. But having already 60 million people, we cannot see logic in going up from that to 90 million to 1,000 million, which you eventually would when you know that there are up to 200 million people in the world at time present who would like to migrate. The answer, as I say, is go back to where they came from and say, let's give you a decent life here, and you won't need to migrate.
So with the projected expansion of population in the UK, where would that put the greenhouse gas emissions in 2050? Would the cuts that we're making in carbon make any difference?
Well, they'll help, but in the projections at the moment, we look as though we're going up from 60 million by a further 10 million by the middle of this century, which is a 1/6 rise. And so in rough and ready terms, you can think of that as being 10 million extra greenhouse gas producers at a British rate, which is 3 million miles of Toyota Prius or 620 transatlantic crossings, return flights, for every one of those 10 million extra people. So we must do all the other things. We must insulate our homes properly. We must have more economical cars. We must try and encourage people to go by train. I haven't got a car, and I go everywhere by bicycle or train. You know, this is the sort of thing we've got to start doing. And I'm totally in favor of all of those things. But in addition, we must stabilize the numbers. Every country should have a population policy, which basically should be a desire for every country to stabilize its numbers and reduce its greenhouse emissions and help the whole world to do the same. And you cannot do that without considering family planning. And I see family planning as a hugely important intervention. I'm totally opposed to coercion because you don't need that. The China way is not necessary. In Africa, I find that when you talk to people, they say, yes, I want it. They want family planning. And they don't have the choice. In Rwanda, they just have condoms or sterilization. The men often won't want to use condoms. They don't have the injections, the IUDs, the pills that we all take for granted. If you made that stuff available for them, they would choose to use it just as we do, and that would be actually a huge step in the right direction.
Are governments prepared to listen to the population argument?
They have the same problem that the voters have, which is this this uncomfortableness about it, this taboo. I have found throughout my life when I've been talking along these lines that people say, okay, you have a quantitative concern about human numbers. You are worried about the quantity of humans on the planet. That must mean you are for coercion. They cannot see you could have a quantitative concern and yet be for voluntary availability of family planning and removal of barriers. So that every couple on the planet who at time present wants to go to bed with their partner and make love can avoid having one more baby that they could probably not properly care for. That's all we're talking about.
And that will help our problem with climate change.
Of course it will, because, I mean, don't just think of climate change, Alex. If you just think of the statistic, which is that every 5 days, a million extra people arrive on the planet. There are 75 million a year, so it's a million every 5 days. Just think of the environmental impact of a city of a million people. If that's got to be produced every 5 days, we're talking on Wednesday as it happens. So since last Thursday or Friday last week, a million people have had to be accommodated in the world since then. Now that, if you put it all together, make a city out of it, think of any city, what it's going to do to habitats, how it's going to destroy the places where frogs live, the trees where the birds roost, and the rest of it.
And they all need
every
to be fed,
days.
Yes.
So if there were fewer people,
mm-hmm.
there wasn't that increment, then you'd need fewer cities. So it's not just climate change, it's everything to do with the environment is helped by stabilizing our numbers. It goes back to what my biologist teacher back in that lecture way back 40 years ago said. We are biological organisms. We can't escape our biology. There is no way any biological organism can go on breeding ad infinitum. Stabilization has to happen. And
where,
it's better sooner rather than later.
Where do we go from here? What organizations do you recommend to find out more?
Well, we have a website, which is just www.optimumpopulation.org, and it's got about a quarter of a million words on it, so there's a lot of information there. There's also another brilliant website, which is www.peopleandplanet.net. I really commend that one to you and to your listeners, because it's holistic and it brings all these aspects of the environment together, but is not pussyfooting about the population factor. So those are two very useful websites. And in the case of population, our one, optimumpopulation.org, there is a place on the website that people can join. And you know, the more our membership increases, the greater an effect we can have. And then as regards trying to help international family planning, if people want to do that, I recommend Murray Stopes' organization. We need money because the wretched Bush administration has actually cut the amount of money that is being given to developing world family planning, which is bananas when you think of the future of the planet.
I'm sorry, I missed the name of that last organization.
Murray Stopes, MarieStopes.
All right.
MarieStopes.org. That's their website. They are the premier group that is providing voluntary family planning for the world, for Africa, for Asia, and everywhere. very good organization to support.
Well, Dr. John Guillebeau, thank you so much for talking to us from London today.
Oh, delighted. Wish you well in all the good work you're doing as well, Alex, and the people you work with.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
On CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Well, I'd like to welcome back Catherine Stewart to the show. It's been a little bit, and we have some important things to talk about when it comes to aquaculture on the coast of British Columbia. Well, as we know, the coast of British Columbia is gigantic, but it is being threatened, on the southern part of it at least, by salmon farming, which is bringing out sea lice and damaging our salmon. Could you tell people about that?
Absolutely. The way that the salmon farms operate in BC is what's called open net cage technology, which are basically nets suspended in the water. And the farms are packed with anywhere from 500,000 to 1,000,000 fish, thousands and thousands per cage. And they are, of course, like any industrial factory farming method, a breeding ground for diseases, but also for a parasite called the sea lice. And the lice breed on the farms and then attack the out-migrating wild juvenile salmon when they're very tiny. They're only about the size of your little finger, the pink and the chum salmon. And so they're extremely susceptible to this parasite, which eats through their flesh, sucks their blood, and kills them. In addition, of course, the open net cage farms also entangle and drown seals and sea lions, harbor porpoises and dolphins who are trying to get at the Atlantic fish that are in the pens. And in a host of ways, through waste deposited on the ocean bottom, disease transfers, escapes, colonization of wild salmon streams, these farms are causing a major environmental problem and huge pressure on our dwindling wild salmon stocks.
That's a long list of problems. So I understand the provincial government struck up a committee to go out and listen to people and come up with some answers. What's come out of that?
Yes, the government established a committee about 18 months ago. It was chaired by the opposition party in British Columbia, the NDP, but also was a bipartisan committee with members of the governing party on the committee as well. They held hearings in coastal communities throughout BC and last week tabled a report and a series of recommendations around the future of farming and how to make salmon farms more sustainable.
And I gather there's been resistance from the government to its own report. What is that about?
Well, there's a lot of resistance because the weight of evidence, of scientific evidence from around the world, indicates that sea lice infesting wild salmon is a huge problem. Unfortunately, both the Canadian federal government and the provincial government scientists prefer to bury their heads in the sand, and almost like the argument on climate change, claim that there isn't proof, there isn't concrete proof. Well, science is like that. Usually what you go with is the weight of scientific evidence, and the vast weight of peer-reviewed evidence indicates there is a problem. The committee recommended some solutions, including no farms north of Vancouver Island in an area where there only are two farms in existence right now. They would grandfather those two existing farms in, but of course the government had a very aggressive expansion agenda for the industry and wanted to see farms spread all up the northern coast of BC. So that's a controversial recommendation, and clearly the salmon farming companies, which are largely Norwegian-owned, are very upset by that. And they also recommended 3 years of research and 2 years of transition to closed, contained tank farming, largely floating ocean-based tanks, which would put an impermeable barrier between the farm fish and the ocean ecosystem and the wild fish. It would virtually eliminate most of the problems. Waste could be recovered, composted, sold as fertilizer, fish could not escape, predators like seals and sea lions would not get tangled in the nets and drown or be shot and killed, which they frequently are by the fish farmers. And the sea lice problem would be addressed and would stop the decimation of our wild stocks. The industry, of course, is resisting this vigorously, saying that it would be too expensive. It's actually, their argument is rather amusing. On the one hand, they say it's not used anywhere in the world, it's untried, it's untested technology, and in the same breath say that it would be prohibitively expensive and the industry would go bankrupt. One has to wonder how they can conclude the cost would be prohibitive if the technology is as untested as they claim. But nonetheless, that's the argument they're making.
Well, let's go back just a little bit about having the farms north of the current line where they are. Alaska isn't allowing fish farming at this time, are they? Not in the sense that we're doing it, right in the estuaries.
No, Alaska has completely banned fish farming, and they do a form of sea ranching where salmon are held in nets during the early stages of their life and then turned loose into the ocean. But it's nowhere near the same thing as the farms, which rear the salmon for their whole life cycle and, of course, have all the waste build up and accumulation and the transfer of diseases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Alaska has banned it. Most of the First Nations north of Vancouver Island along the mainland coast of BC are totally opposed to having fish farms. In fact, the majority of the population, people who rely on commercial fishing, tourism, sports fishing, they all want to protect the wild salmon economy in these areas. There is one First Nation, the Kitisu people, who have two farms in their territory, and the committee recommends that those would be grandfathered in and allowed to continue. And there is another First Nation, the Kitkatla, whose elected chief counselor is trying to lure the farms into their territory, but the majority of his people are vigorously opposed to this.
It's not just environmentalists, then, that are objecting to this, when, especially in the north.
No, it's not at all, and in the south as well. First Nations, commercial fishermen, the Wilderness Tourism Association in southern British Columbia has been a staunch opponent of fish farming. They've made their views known quite publicly, and they're a multi-million dollar industry. The problem from their perspective is that wild salmon are the backbone of the coastal temperate rainforest ecosystem. Everything revolves around the wild salmon. The bears, the eagles, the orca whales, even the forest itself feeds off the carcasses of the salmon that are dragged up into the woods by predators.
That's the fertilizer, then.
That's the fertilizer, and about 75% of the nitrogen that feeds those ancient trees, those thousand-year-old cedars in the riparian zones, comes from the wild salmon. So the entire wilderness tourism industry and the sports fishing lodges, all of them are dependent for their business and their survival on healthy wild salmon stocks, and they see the fish farms as a major threat to their future.
So what do you see the next step happening here in British Columbia?
Well, sad to say, I think the government will do everything in its power to bury this report and resist implementing any of the recommendations, but there will be a vigorous campaign by Living Ocean Society, our allies in the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform, by First Nations, by the tourism industry, to see these recommendations implemented. We're hoping there's an entrepreneur who is trying to raise the last funds needed to set up a commercial-scale closed tank project this year. And we're hoping he's successful and can prove that the technology works and is economically viable. One of the things that the industry keeps claiming is that in order to use these closed tanks, you'd have to rely on power to pump the water, and therefore it would be a greenhouse gas contributor, and it's just a really backwards approach. And they're claiming that, you know, raising the fish in open nets relies on the sun and the tides, and it all sounds so benign. But what they're not talking about is the consumption of fossil fuel involved in the open net cages. They're located in very remote areas. All of the supplies, the feed for the fish themselves, the crews, everything has to be brought in by boat, diesel-consuming boats.
And the feed comes all the way from Chile in some cases, doesn't it?
Largely, yes. And then, of course, because they're in remote locations, they're off the grid, and so they're using diesel generators to power the farms. It's a highly mechanized industry that doesn't employ anywhere near as many people as the fish farmers have long claimed. The committee also undertook an economic analysis, and the fish farming industry has said for years that it employs 5,000 people in BC, and the economists who did the analysis for the committee concluded it was a maximum of 2,900 people, and that includes direct jobs, indirect jobs, and what are known as induced jobs, jobs in a cafe, for example, that might serve the fish processing plant.
So these big companies, foreign-owned companies, generally can parachute in a factory farming operation right in one of our major salmon-bearing estuaries, and then if the salmon are decimated, I guess they just declare bankruptcy or they'll move on, and we're left with nothing. You can't just regenerate the salmon, can we?
Well, it's a struggle to regenerate the salmon, and you reduce the genetic diversity when you are artificially enhancing salmon rivers, and that genetic diversity is very important for their long-term survival. So it's very true. It's a, you know, a cut and run type operation. If things don't work out for them here economically, or if it's cheaper to farm in Chile because the labor laws are less stringent there, then that's where they'll move to. But it's true that if the government of British Columbia is more interested in the future of our children and the future health of our province, then they will embrace this report and implement its recommendations. Unfortunately, I'm afraid the government is going to be more interested in the bottom line profits of a couple of very large Norwegian corporations.
And so it goes. We've been talking with Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society, and I really want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Alex. My pleasure.
You are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to Radio EcoShock this week. I hope you found it useful. You can download this entire show or selected interviews from our website at www.ecoshock.org. And check out our huge library of green audio available as free MP3 downloads. We'll head on out with classic Marvin Gaye, The Ecology Song.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon high seas. Fish full of mercury. Mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to do. Lost my radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are not. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more will you from me? Can't you stand?